I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Okay, let's all take a deep breath. New numbers released today show the unemployment rate last month jumped to a 14-year high of 6.5%. Ford Motor Company says it will now cut 2,200 jobs because of quarterly losses. Here in Boston, mutual fund giant Fidelity will cut 1,300 workers. President-elect Barack Obama huddles with his economic team today ahead of his first news conference this afternoon. What will he do about the economy? What can he do? Joining us is Greg Ip, U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist magazine. And Greg, there are reports that Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson wants Obama to co-own the $700 billion bailout plan, and that Obama is resisting, sort of shades of FDR distancing himself from the outgoing Herbert Hoover in 1932. How do you see it?
Robin, I think that perhaps overstates the tensions a little bit. Paulson, most of all, wants to get this program right. And so he has announced some pretty aggressive steps to put a lot of money into banks first and foremost, and that program closes on November 14th. He does plan to reach out to the transition team, but as I understand it, there has not been extensive contact yet. In any case, Paulson's a pretty pragmatic person, and I strongly doubt that he's about to go in any particular direction that is going to be much at odds with the incoming Obama people.
Where does the bailout plan stand?
Well, so far they have the $700 billion authorized by Congress, and they have committed $250 billion of that to capital purchases, which essentially means putting equity of the government into banks. And so far, $125 billion of that has been committed to the nine largest firms. And then there are many other banks that are still in the process of signing up. But after that, Robin, it's an open question where they go, because there are companies that are not literally banks who are reaching out saying, hey, we're important, we're financial companies, we'd like to qualify too.
So there are questions as to whether or not the bailout should be expanded to other industries. But in the meantime, is it working? We were hearing reports that the money that was given to the banks so far is being hoarded, that the banks aren't spending it as was hoped and freeing up some of the credit.
It's hard to isolate exactly what the benefit of this program is versus other things that have been done. But I would say, Robin, that actually the signs are somewhat encouraging in the last few weeks. If you ignore the lurching ups and downs of the Dow, for example, the so-called interbank rate that banks charge on loans to each other has come down sharply from over 4% to a little over 2%. So I think that's a positive sign. We've seen some mortgage rates move down. But I don't want to overstate this. Things are still extremely fragile out there. And as for the controversy over banks hoarding the money, even though they may be using the money to buy each other or to pay dividends or so forth, that's not necessarily a sign that the program's not working, because one of the things that we would like to see at the end of this process is that the weak banks be taken over by the strong banks, as opposed to simply failing and taking down large chunks of their customers with them.
Yeah. Well, Barack Obama is convening his new economic advisory board in Chicago today, not in Washington. It includes billionaire investor Warren Buffett, two former Treasury Secretaries, Lawrence Summers and Robert Rubin, former Fed Chair Paul Volcker, the CEO of Google, the mayor of Los Angeles, the governor of Michigan. What's the thinking about the first concrete steps they have to take?
I think the first step they have to do, Robin, is start telling us who the key individuals in their economic team will be. There's a lot of speculation and questions now on who the next Treasury Secretary will be. Most of the speculation has focused on Lawrence Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, and Tim Geithner, who is currently President of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. They have to start quickly addressing how they're going to go about doing new fiscal stimulus. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, has signaled that she would like to move a stimulus package of up to $100 billion during the current lame duck session of Congress, and I think Obama will sign on to that. And we'd like to see whether Obama intends to accelerate some parts of his policy platform, such as worker tax credits, to be part of that stimulus program. But he has to tread carefully here, Robin, because he has some very expensive promises in his policy program as well.
Well, Floyd Norris writes in the New York Times today that Barack Obama has to be very careful to really know what candidates for economic jobs really believe. And we've had listeners write to ask about some of the candidates for the jobs, asking why in particular Lawrence Summers would be a candidate. He left Harvard after making comments about women's lack of skills in math and science. Or why so many Clintonites in general? Why Paul Volcker, another throwback as a former Fed chair? Why not Nobel Prize winning liberal economist Joseph Stiglitz or Robert Krugman or Robert Kuttner? You know, why not the change that Obama had pledged?
Getting the theatrics, if I may call it that, right, is very important here. People like Joe Stiglitz and Paul Paul Krugman are brilliant economists, exceptionally articulate writers and so forth, but they are known more for holding very strong and opinionated views, not for having been in the thick and the muck of bailouts and rescues, the sort of stuff that we're in the middle of right now, where you really can't approach a problem with a preset ideological point of view. You have to be very open-minded because the world is constantly throwing unexpected challenges at you.
Greg, thank you. Greg Ipp, U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist. Well, Time magazine writes this week, Senator Barack Obama has proved to be a biracial icon. Perhaps his mixed parentage gave him the multicultural background needed to be culturally bilingual, creating the dialogue that may bridge our divide. Well, culturally bilingual is a language that's still being written, and today, two mothers trying to decipher it. They wrote about raising biracial children for Brainchild, the magazine for thinking mothers. Let's go first to Dionne Ford. She's a freelance journalist from New Jersey, an African-American. Her husband is white, and their 7-year-old daughter, Desiree, is still trying to figure it out. Dionne, your essay is called Black on the Inside, and you talk about your struggle not to impose racial identity on your daughter, but it gets hard because how does she see herself?
Well, in March, when she turned 7, she was calling herself white. Yeah. And, yeah, it does get complicated. I mean, of course, I wanted for her to be able to identify herself, self-identify, but I just never considered that she might not identify with me.
Right. And she seems aware, at least in your writing, of like kind of like averting your eyes at times, knowing that this might, you know, hurt you.
Yeah, I mean, I picked up on the fact that she understood that this meant something between us when she was 5 and first mentioned she thought she was white, and at the time she was talking about because of the color of her skin. She was more light-complected than me.
Is she light-complected? In other words, how would society probably see your daughter?
You know, that's such a tricky question. To my eyes, she looks so clearly a mixed-race child. But, you know, I think it depends on people's experiences and how much they know people of different ethnicities.
Right. And we want to reinforce, you've been so careful not to impose thinking on your daughter. She came up with this herself.
Yes.
So there's these exchanges, like she comes home around, it seems like it's around the Martin Luther King Day celebrations, probably hearing at school about Rosa Parks and the struggle of blacks. And she says to you, being black is too hard. How'd that hit you?
Like a ton of bricks, because on the one hand, things have changed a lot from the time that she's talking about. And yes, they had been talking about in school the civil rights movement. So she was talking about the difficult things that she was hearing about. But also, at the same time, you know, even though I didn't live through that era, I've certainly experienced difficulties. Mm-hmm. No other way to say it, being black. So, you know, it was a double-edged sword, I think.
Well, in fact, you find out from your sister, after you're going through all of this, you know, emotional hand-wringing over your daughter's decisions, your sister reminds you that, in fact, it was so hard for you to be black when you were a kid because of some other, the way some other kids treated you, that you wanted to be white.
Yeah, that was really interesting. Because when I told my sister the story was going to be published, she just, you know, very quickly piped up, oh, yeah, you know, you used to feel the same way, too. And we kind of had a conversation about how really not very unusual it is to think that. We actually grew up in a very mixed-race little town because it was right outside of an Air Force base and an Army base. So you get a lot of people going overseas and marrying someone of another race, and it was an issue. I knew growing up that people didn't identify themselves like that, biracial or anything like that. If you were at all black, then you were black. And I knew that really clearly because I had a very light-skinned grandfather from New Orleans who did actually pass for white when he lived there to earn money. But he would never identify himself as a white man in any other circumstance. And he was very clear about the fact that he did that for financial reasons. And even once when I was little, I asked him, you know, if he was white. And he, you know, was very clear about saying, are you kidding me? Of course I'm not. You know, so that just wasn't something that was done.
And your daughter said to you at one point, that, you know, I think you write that she saw something in your face when she was saying, well, I'm white, that she reassured you by saying, but Mom, I'm black on the inside because I grew up inside you.
Yeah.
And that touched a nerve with you, though, because, and by the way, your daughter has just, you know, priceless way of putting things, but it touched a nerve with you because growing up, you had a reverse issue. People had called you white on the inside.
Yeah. You know, I grew up in a town that at the time I think was pretty much predominantly white, the town that we moved to. And, you know, most of my classes were white, and I was in whatever the AP classes or whatever you want to call them. And to do that, to be like that, was considered by my black peers to be white. And so it wasn't really a compliment.
Right. Dionne, you write about your feelings about Barack Obama identifying primarily as black.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's more of my era, so I understand why he would do that. I don't think there would have really been much opportunity for him to describe himself any other way.
What would you have preferred?
Well, I think now I would love to see him describe himself as a biracial person, because he is. But like I say, you know, I understand he grew up when I grew up, and you didn't really have that option. Mm-hmm. So I do understand that. But, you know, it's been nice for my daughter to see someone who's biracial in the national spotlight like this. And it has opened up yet another conversation.
Right.
So,
gee, Barack Obama has no problem identifying himself as black.
Yeah.
Sweetheart.
We had that conversation.
Well, part of this might be generational. We know that many teenagers today truly don't see race. They say they don't. But it sounds like you're telling us that your daughter is grappling with it, and that's been painful for you.
Now that she's a little bit older, it's a lot easier. But when she was younger, really what she was doing was just bringing out these things that I'd never really reconciled for myself. And I think that's why they touched such a nerve. They were things that I felt were just so far behind me, you know. Hearing her kind of go through this identity thing, you know, really brought up a lot of stuff in me.
You mean that in kind of navigating your own life, I mean, you write about how a white friend told you to stay away from the family dog because the father had trained it to attack black people. I mean, you know, the fact that you did ultimately embrace your blackness came at some, sacrifice at that time, and then here she would be rejecting it.
Yeah. It's pretty complicated. I mean, on the one hand, I'm so excited that she lives in a time where she gets to say who she is. That's fantastic. At the same time, it's taken me all this time to really, you know, embrace who I am and not want to change it at all.
That's Dionne Ford. She wrote the essay Black on the Inside for the publication Brain Child, the magazine for thinking mothers. When we come back, a white mother raising two adopted black children, one of whom is biracial, with a different set of questions. And later today, who might the candidates be for an Obama Supreme Court? And while we're at it, a quick correction. We were talking about candidates for his economic team. I said Robert Krugman. Of course, I meant Nobel winner Paul Krugman, our frequent guest on our program. We're talking about raising biracial kids. We just spoke with Dionne Ford, the black mother of a biracial daughter. Let's go now to Margaret Gunther. She's a writer from Portland, Oregon. She's white. Her husband is Indian. And they adopted two African-American boys, one of whom is biracial. Now, we've spoken here with adoption advocate Adam Pertman, who says there should be counseling before interracial adoptions. Some adoptive parents found that insulting. Others worried that any kind of requirements for interracial adoptions would be a slippery slope that would ultimately end them. But Margaret, while there are millions of mixed-race adoptions with no issues, it sounds like you have a lot of questions and could use some help. You write, you don't live in a community where there are many other mixed-race families. Your essay in Brainchild magazine is titled Ebony, Ivory, Perplexed. And in it, you write that even the semantics of what to identify your sons is confusing for you. Do I have that right?
Oh, yeah, I just struggle with terminology from time to time. I find myself saying black. I find myself saying African-American. And I wondered one day if there was a perceived difference because I hear people refer to themselves both ways. I'm African-American. I'm black. But it also called to mind the day that Kerry's wife.
Teresa Hines.
John Kerry's wife. Yeah. Right. How she stood before a crowd of people at a rally, and she was raised in South Africa, and she was addressing a largely black crowd, and she referred to herself as, "I am an African-American." And there was a lot of grumbling in the crowd, I understand. People, they didn't like that. They didn't like her claiming that identity. So it meant something.
Yeah.
And I was just exploring the differences of those two words.
Right. And this is a part of your story that you're not sure what to do. In fact, you talk about, you're very honest. You say that when black people look at you with your kids, you feel a little bit like an imposter.
Sometimes, yeah, I do. I feel like I'm someone who's gone out on a limb, or I'm someone who isn't qualified, you know, to raise black children, because it is such a strong identity in our country to be black. It means something. So I want to honor that. I want to be worthy of that. I want to do right by my children culturally, ethnically, and it doesn't feel burdensome. It just feels something that I'm aware of.
What kinds of questions do you have? What kinds of things do you want to know, Margaret?
If I'm doing enough, you know, or if I'm doing too much. My husband's racial identity always gets lost in the family shuffle, and he's Indian, and he's very perplexed by all this because he just thinks all of my worrying and all of my angst is just a manifestation of white guilt. And that there might be some of that in there. I don't know. I think the best thing that I try to do for them is encourage them to love themselves and see them and be proud of their identity and their heritage, and expose them to a lot of different cultural differences, books, literature, music, not just African American, although I do that, but to instill in them a curiosity about the world and themselves and everything that's out there.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I'm doing enough because, well, I don't know. There's no way of knowing. I won't know until they grow up and they get a little bit older and then they choose to identify themselves or who they hang with and how they deal with their own racial identity and cultural identity. At the moment, sometimes they struggle more with being adopted, period, than with being African-American and biracial. My older son is biracial. So that is an issue that is a bit more prevalent right now. But
right.
I think later, their way of identifying themselves racially is going to become, well, Micah is black. That's what he is.
Margaret, you have a recurring dream that you write about where one of your sons comes to you and says he's white. And when you look at him in the mirror, he is. How do we interpret that? I mean, let's put you on the couch for a second. Are you afraid you've made him white or?
No, I'm not afraid that I've made him white. I think in our family, my mother-in-law lives with us, so I'm the only white-skinned person in our little nuclear family. So what I'm afraid of is that I'm not exposing him to enough black culture. I'm not bringing, you know, we moved about 5 years ago, and Portland is a pretty white town. And my friends asked me, why didn't you move to North Portland, which is a part of town where there's a larger black community? And my choices for where we ended up moving, there were a lot of variables, but I felt very guilty about that afterwards. Wow, why didn't I? Why didn't I move to a more diverse neighborhood? Although the school that they go to is an inner city school and it's very diverse. But I had to ask myself that question. So I would rather err on the side of exposing them to a lot of different cultures and celebrating and honoring their African heritage rather than not. You know, rather than pretending that they're just who they are, which I want them to be, but it's a very fine line to walk.
So, Margaret, how has Barack Obama affected the way your sons, especially your biracial son Isaiah, look at themselves?
It's been really fantastic. It represents opportunity and a real shift in the national consciousness, I think, or hopefully.
And I'm just wondering if somewhere in your mind, Barack Obama might help your sons in a way that you're worried you can't.
No, yes, I agree with you. It does. A sense of unique pride in his identity, as proud as I am of him and tell him so all the time, and his brother too. I'm proud of who they are because of who they are, but also because Our family has just always celebrated diversity. That's just from the time I was very young. I think my mother always had a kind of an affinity for otherness. But aside from representing opportunity, it's just, it makes Isaiah very proud to be who he is.
That's Margaret Gunther, a white mom who's adopted one black and one biracial child. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Well, two biracial girls will be growing up in the White House. Jacqueline Kennedy's former Social Secretary Letitia Baldrus said today that it's the Obama daughters, 10-year-old Malia and 7-year-old Sasha, who might have the hardest transition.
Mama and Papa are not going to be available to those adorable little girls as much as the little girls would like.
And some of us will get used to their names. It's, of course, Malia. Baldrige also says that with First Lady so much more active, it will be harder for Michelle Obama to juggle her many roles than it was for Mrs. Kennedy, but serving the country is worth it. First Lady Laura Bush will give Michelle Obama a tour of the White House on Monday. For us on Monday, a man who cleaned out foreclosed homes tells us what he found.
An X-ray of a back and a card from a daughter, you know, encouraging her mother to hang in there, etc. A letter from the sheriff, unpaid bills. And what I deduced was that this was someone who had had an accident and couldn't pay for her medical bills. And so she refinanced the home to cover her medical coverage and got in over her head and lost her home.
That's Monday. Still ahead today, an Obama Supreme Court here and now. The presidential race featured stark contrasts on judicial appointments. Barack Obama voted against Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito when he was in the Senate, and has said that they and the court too often side with the powerful against the powerless, that they lack empathy for ordinary people. John McCain said during the debates that he wouldn't have a litmus test for appointees, but he's also said that Roe v. Wade should be overturned, and he blasted the current court when it ruled that Guantanamo detainees had rights to full federal review of their petitions for release. McCain called that one of the worst decisions in the history of the country. Well, as we know, Barack Obama is the president-elect, so if there is a vacancy, it will be his choice to make a nomination. What will he do? Columnist Stuart Taylor speculates about that in the National Journal. He joins us from the Christian Science Monitor studios in Washington. And Stuart, remind us first, what is the makeup of the current court?
There are 9 members. At the moment, it's exquisitely balanced with 4 pretty consistent liberals, 4 pretty consistent conservatives in varying degrees, and 1, I wouldn't really call him a centrist, Justice Anthony Kennedy. He's kind of liberal sometimes and conservative sometimes. So depending on how he swings, determines in the most politically controversial cases often where the court goes.
And the left was concerned because the oldest judges are perceived as liberal, and potentially a John McCain presidency would mean they'd be replaced if, you know, they stepped down with conservatives.
Yes, there was a lot of talk in the media about, you know, it would be the most conservative Supreme Court in history because Justice Stevens, one of the liberals, is 88. He's the oldest. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 75. She's the second oldest. And then Justice Souter, always relatively young on the Supreme Court scale, 68, is said to want to retire. So if one of them had been replaced by a conservative, it would have represented a sharp move to the right in the court. What got a little less attention is that if one of the conservatives on the court is replaced by a liberal, it would produce an equally sharp move to the left and perhaps the most liberal Supreme Court, at least since the Warren Court.
You really set out in a nifty paragraph what the fears of each side were up till Election Day. You say the liberal nightmare is that McCain might replace one or more aging liberals with conservatives who overrule or hollow out Roe v. Wade, throw gay rights into reverse, discard the constitutional right to privacy, outlaw all racial preferences and school integration programs, narrow the reach of civil rights protections for women, minorities, and the disabled, bless virtually unrestricted government funding of religious schools and sponsorship of crosses, stop shrinking and start expanding the death penalty, mow down gun control laws. The list goes on. What is the conservative nightmare? Because Barack Obama has one.
If for some reason he replaces a conservative with a liberal, conservative nightmare would be an Obama court requiring taxpayers to fund essentially unlimited abortion rights throughout pregnancy, ordering all 50 states to bless gay marriage, expanding and perpetuating use of racial preferences far beyond the 25-year phase-out suggested by the justices 5 years ago, prohibiting tuition vouchers for religious schools, stripping under God from the Pledge of Allegiance, banning the death penalty, striking down the new federal wiretap law, expanding judicial oversight of military detention, CIA interrogations,
and the list goes
other, and on.
And the list goes on.
And also welfare rights might be worth throwing in at this point.
Well, but what has Barack Obama said about what he might do through a Supreme Court?
He's praised the more liberal justices on the court. He's praised the Warren Court. Sometimes he sounds like he wants, you know, a very, and it's clearly at a point fairly liberal justices. The question is whether it appoint real crusading liberals. And sometimes he sounds like that. At other times, on specifics, and by the way, of course, he's taught constitutional law. He's probably very well qualified to sit on the Supreme Court himself, unlike any other president in a while, so he knows these issues. He did denounce the decision that barred use of the death penalty for raping a child. It was a 5-4 decision won by the liberals, and Obama said he thought it was wrong. The other case where he went against the liberals was the gun case, where the court struck down the District of Columbia very strict gun control law. Obama applauded that.
Well, what has he said about what kind of Supreme Court judge he holds up? You write he's talked specifically about judges that he's admired.
Yes, I think he mentioned both of the Clinton-appointed judges, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, who are liberal but not as liberal as, say, some of the lions of the Warren Court were. I'd say they're moderate liberals, some in his party would be upset if he appointed a clone of them. They want a crusading liberal, someone like Earl Warren proved to be, someone like William Brennan, someone like Thurgood Marshall, and he's praised them as well. So he's kind of kept his options open in terms of whether he goes a little bit liberal or a lot liberal with appointments.
Yeah. Give us some of the names of the potential Supreme Court nominees. Of course, this is just speculation, but give us some of the names.
Yeah, I named a few in the article you mentioned, and it was difficult because there's a lot of people who are good candidates, and it wasn't easy to figure out which ones would rise to the top of the list, but the ones who came closest to doing that, in my judgment, were a woman named Elena Kagan, dean of Harvard Law School, and was and has been applauded by a very broad swath of people at Harvard Law School. The conservatives at Harvard Law School like her. That would be probably a pretty consensus choice. Cass Sunstein, a professor at Harvard Law School who Obama knew when they both taught at the University of Chicago Law School, is another. Hillary Rodham Clinton has made some lists, although she said, I think, that she's not interested. And there are others. Diane Wood, a justice in Chicago, appeals judge, a woman named Sonia Sotomayor, an appeals court judge in New York. The two big credentials that a lot of people will be looking for are it should be a woman and or a person of color, especially woman. You know, half the graduates of law school these days are women, and there's 1 out of 9 on the Supreme Court, and there's a pretty universal perception that, you know, it ought to be a little bit more balanced than that. And so I think Obama would look for a woman, although that's not to say he wouldn't appoint a man if he was personally close to him and had a lot of personal confidence in the person, as in the case of Cass Sunstein, or also Eric Holder, who's also been mentioned and who happens to be African American, which might lead some people to forgive him for not being a woman.
Cass Sunstein, by the way, recently married Samantha Power, who was the friend of Obama's and former foreign policy advisor to the candidate, you remind us. Well, you also write that even more important than the Supreme Court is that there will be Obama appointments on federal district and appeals courts, and that they could be even more important, although less visible. Now, why do you think there's an importance there?
A number tells a story to an extent. There are 13 federal appellate judicial circuit courts scattered around mostly by geography, and they're the real gatekeepers. They set a lot of legal policy. They decide about 60,000 cases a year. The Supreme Court reviews about 70 cases a year. That's a little over 1 in 1,000. Now, of course, the Supreme Court steps in the very biggest cases on the very biggest and most politicized issues and the ones on which the lower courts tend to be divided, which happens a lot. And so the Supreme Court is very important, but I think just because of natural attrition, in an 8-year term, Bush appointed 326 lower court judges, which is about a third of the total.
Stuart Taylor, writing for the National Journal, does a deep piece on what a Supreme Court might look like in a Barack Obama presidency. Stuart, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And time for a quick heads up here. Next Tuesday is Veterans Day. We're going to have the story of Marine Colonel John Ripley. He may be the greatest war hero you've never heard of. So tune in next Tuesday. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's Friday, so let's wrap up the sports week. And because our ace reporter is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, we will, of course, go far afield from sports. Bill, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. I'm happy to be here again, Robin.
And we'll start on the field. It's still early in the NFL season, but there's still an undefeated team, the Tennessee Titans. Are they that good, or is it that early?
Well, there's not only an undefeated team. There is an opposite of an undefeated team, which I guess you would say is a defeated team. The Lions are 0-8. Tennessee is 8-0. Tennessee is very good, and they play 5-3 Chicago this weekend, and I would guess that after that they'd probably be 9-0, and Detroit plays 3-5 Jacksonville, and I would guess they would probably be 0-9.
Okay.
So maybe we'll see one of those terrific seasons with bookends.
Well, terrific, unless you're on that other bookend.
Yeah.
Turning to professional basketball, this week All-Star guard Allen Iverson traded to the Detroit Pistons. They gave up two mainstays. Good deal?
Well, you never can tell with this sort of thing. I think probably it's going to turn out to be a good deal for Detroit because Detroit already had a very good team, and adding Allen Iverson to it, assuming he can work himself comfortably into the mix, should make them a very good team. But you never know. They're undefeated in this early going. I think they're 4-0 or something like that. So if they lose tonight against the Nets, we'll know that at least in the short run it wasn't a good deal.
Bad idea. Let's turn to the big news of the week. I mean, come on, I know a few things happened this week. Barack Obama on his way to the White House, but so is basketball.
That's
apparently.
Right. Well, the Celtics talked about how much fun it would be to win another championship because their roster was in favor of Obama except for one member. There was one vote for McCain
and
on
their
roster.
And very spirited talks on the team playing.
Exactly. And they, as a matter of fact, I'm told that they celebrated President-elect Obama's election more enthusiastically than they celebrated the game that they won on the same night, which is kind of interesting. Anyway, that's an added incentive for them to win another championship and go to the White House.
Well, the fact that Obama's there, perhaps for them, but he also is going to build a basketball court at
the White
House.
I'm told that because he's a basketball player, he may very well put a basketball court somewhere. And I understand that as a player, he goes to his left very well. So I can only hope that as a president, he will go to his left very well. And that's only my opinion, and not to be taken as National Public Radio's position.
Bill Littlefield there, ladies and gentlemen. By the way, the past history, Nixon put in the bowling lane, Eisenhower had a putting green, and President Bush has a t-ball game on the South Lawn. It's for kids.
So don't forget the Easter egg hunt.
Yes,
because in only a game, we'd probably consider that a sport worth reporting on, too.
Well, you know, a basketball court may not be the only change coming. In interviews before the election, Barack Obama said he'd like to see a playoff system put in place for deciding college football's national champion. Now, remind people why people are calling for change. And
well,
can he do that?
The current system, and I use system in the loosest possible sense of the word, is the bowl championship series. And nobody is really happy with the bowl championship series because it involves computer rankings and involves guessing games, and it involves rather arbitrary decisions about who should play whom for the alleged national championship. Lots of people would be happier with a playoff system, Barack Obama among them. That doesn't necessarily make him especially radical.
Can he do it, though? Can a president?
Oh, I shouldn't think so.
No, okay.
I think he probably has many more important things to worry about than how the football college champion is determined.
But staying with politics in our sports segment here, he does have one other thing. We understand the White Sox have made an invitation.
Well, they want him to throw out the first pitch of the 2009 Major League Baseball season, and it's no wonder because in 2005, when he threw out the first pitch in their second game in the playoffs, they went on a winning streak that led them to winning the World Series that year. So maybe if he does throw out the first pitch in April next, they'll go 162-0.
Yeah. Well, just one last thing because I have to get this in here. I know everyone who listens to Only a Game knows you are such a proud soccer dad. And you have yet another reason, Mr. Lefty, to like Obama.
I beg your pardon? Yes, Barack said his favorite athlete to watch was his daughter when she was on the soccer pitch. And that's okay with me.
Yeah, his
absolutely.
Daughter, Malia. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And when we come back, a PBS program poses a provocative question. Can you put God on trial? Back in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. From Sophie's Choice to Schindler's List, it's a familiar scene. Jewish prisoners marched into a dark, damp barracks, deprived of food and dignity as they await certain death. But this week's episode of Masterpiece on PBS opens a different window on the Holocaust. Joining us is Here and Now critic at large Ed Siegel. And Ed, the title of the drama is God on Trial, which, no matter how secular you may be, is a pretty good hook.
You said it.
Do prisoners literally put God on trial?
Yeah, and, you know, when I first came across this title, I thought the trial would be about whether God exists or not. But the prisoners, they take that for granted in their anger over their fate. They're really putting God on trial for breaking his covenant with the Jewish people. By the way, forgive me for being gender specific, but since they all talk about God as a he, maybe we can too.
Well, I think that's fine. Well, you know, I feel I have this image in my head of 20th century artists, you know, shaking their fist at God, asking why me, very Job-like. So what's different here?
Well, as we noted, this is a different take on the Holocaust and on the theological debate about how bad things can happen to good people. And what a debate this is. The sharpness of Frank Cottrell Boyce's dialogue, along with the setting, makes this really superior drama. Let's take a listen to this scene where Rabbi Schmidt, played by Stephen Delane, defends God.
What if those who survive this will be a holy remnant and will live in an age of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge? What if some great good were to come of this? Already some say the Messiah himself. Perhaps a return to Israel. What then?
Then it might be a beautiful thing.
So, you see.
Ah, so the defense makes its case and rests. And then the prosecutor. Tell us about the prosecutor.
That's another excellent actor, and this program is full of them. It's Rupert Graves playing Mordecai, a secular Jew. And in his rebuttal, he argues sarcastically that if God meant for all this to be the war, the Holocaust, then everything that the Nazis have been doing has been for the good.
If Hitler is doing God's work, then logic says that to stand in Hitler's way is to stand in God's way. To take arms against Hitler is wrong. Now, does anybody here believe that? Is there any way that that could possibly be true? Isn't that insane?
Who are you addressing?
God on Trial. It runs 90 minutes. It all takes place within the confines of a barracks room in Auschwitz. It feels like, you know, 12 Angry Men. You know, it feels like the remaking of an old drama.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Robin. While I was watching it, I kept thinking of classic TV shows like Playhouse 90 that really hinged on the dialogue, even when great filmmakers like Arthur Penn directed them. But here, I also have to give a tip of the hat to how the program shot. The prisoners being marched into the concentration camp are intercut with the scenes of modern-day tourists getting off the bus to visit the camp. And a similar device is used at the end. It's really a remarkable way of framing the story and breaking down the distance between the viewers and the prisoners.
Well, speaking of the end, we don't want to give it away, but what can you say about it?
Well, you know, you can certainly apply the word existential to it, but maybe we'd better leave it at that. But truth be told, the trial's more interesting than the verdict. Nevertheless, this is really meaty stuff and riveting drama. And for most of it, you know, you have one of the world's great actors, Anthony Scheer, who just sits there and you think, what a waste. But playing a rabbi, he gets up toward the end, and does he ever make his presence felt as he compares Jewish suffering to suffering of all humanity?
God is not good. When he asked Abraham to sacrifice his son, Abraham should have said no. We should have taught our God the justice that was in our hearts. We should have stood up to him. He is not good. He has simply been strong. He has simply been on our side. Is there any other explanation? What do we see here? His power, his majesty, his might, all these things, but turned against us. He is still God. But not our God. He has become our enemy.
And it only gets more powerful from there, Robin.
God on Trial. It airs this Sunday on Masterpiece. Ed Siegel, critic at large for Here and Now. Thanks so much for sharing some of it with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's get some of your thoughts in before we go. J.K. of Framingham, Massachusetts, wrote after our piece yesterday about the increase in gun sales after Barack Obama's election because of fears that Obama would tighten gun laws. Jay took issue with my comment that more guns in circulation means more will fall in the hands of criminals. He writes, the problem is the lack of uniformity of laws. For instance, Massachusetts has requirements that guns be locked up. That makes theft harder. Jay also ridiculed Obama's past support of a law that would allow lawsuits against gun manufacturers whose products were used to commit crimes. Jay writes, that's absurd. If one were to bludgeon someone with a baseball bat, should Louisville Slugger be held liable? But he also adds, fear of Obama? Incredible. I voted for McCain and have legitimate issues with the new president-elect on energy, taxes, but I must admit to being thrilled at the thought of an African-American president. I still get a lump in my throat at the thought of it. It's as if the Civil War is finally over. Well, most of the letters this week were about Obama's election and how it prompted memories for news anchor Dolores Handy Brown, who told us of growing up in the late 40s and 50s in segregated Little Rock, Arkansas, with its separate water fountains and schools. Randy Newcomb of Amherst, New Hampshire, writes, her heartfelt thoughts, filtered through memories of so many small indignities, represented one of those work-stopping moments. I could almost see her smiling at the implicit wonder of how now, as a news anchor, she'll be able to hold our new president's feet to the fire. R. Wayne Campbell wrote from Dover, New Hampshire. He's white and grew up in the South before he joined the military and moved first to Maine. Dolores mentioned the poll tax, which was levied on blacks to keep them from voting. Wayne writes, it reminded me when I was honorably discharged from the Navy, I too was required to pay a poll tax in Maine. At the time, I thought nothing of it, but in hindsight, I wonder what they didn't like about me. By the way, I really feel uplifted by what happened in the election. There's hope for this country. Mind you, I voted for Bush in 2000. And Doug Dutton wrote, he's now 61, lives in Birmingham, Alabama, and we decided to call him because, Doug, Dolores prompted a memory for you of high school graduation.
I was on the stage, and it fell to me to introduce our keynote speaker, Eugene Bull Connor. He was infamous in the 60s, which I witnessed, turning the hoses on the blacks as they were demonstrating in downtown Birmingham.
Doug, how did you feel introducing him then?
I probably was oblivious to the symbol that he had come to represent at the time.
And how did you feel this week going in to vote?
I felt very proud to cast my vote for Barack Obama. I saw a lot of things over my years that were against the blacks. I wasn't looking to just vote for a black. I happened to really embrace most of what Obama stands for.
So you're voting for Barack Obama because you thought he was the better candidate. But Doug, was there a part of you, maybe the high school memory part of you, also, in some small way, doing a make-good, make-up for the past?
I was glad that I could make good, but I did feel he was the qualified candidate, and so it made it possible for me to make good, as you say.
Yeah. Well, Doug, thanks so much for sharing that with us.
Okay, well, thank you for calling, Robin.
Well, by the way, several schools have been using Dolores Handy Brown's thoughts as teaching tools. If you're interested, go to our website, here-now.org. And while there, you'll also find our interview with pianist Keith Jarrett. Many of you wrote in appreciation. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend. And please join us again here and now.